Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today as we visit with Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host. She's an author, a columnist, over 30 years of horticulture experience. She's written over 20 gardening books and has just released the second edition of Midwest Gardener's Handbook and All You Need to Know to Plan, Plant, and Maintain a Midwest Garden. It's a dandy book. So we'll talk with her about how to create a pollinator-friendly garden, and of course we'll take your questions as well, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Melinda Myers, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always great to chat with you and your listeners, Larry, and we've actually had some decent gardening weather, but it's Wisconsin, so you never know.
You never know. And here we are coming into June is National Pollinator Month. And that's a pretty cool thing you're doing. You're partnering with the Wisconsin Public Libraries to offer free pollinator education webinars for adults and also programming and projects for kids. Tell us about that.
You bet. So I've been partnering with American Transmission Company for years, encouraging people to grow pollinator-friendly plants just like they do under their transmission lines. And who better to join the team than the libraries? And we're doing it with the libraries throughout Wisconsin and the UP of Michigan. And we decided to make everybody aware of and have fun activities the whole family can do in the month of June. So I'm offering several webinars, creating pollinator-friendly gardens, attracting native bees to your landscape, because we often overlook them. We know about the honeybees, but our native bees are important. And then how to manage your landscape with pollinators in mind. But one of the things I'm excited about is activities. I did several videos. We have activity sheets for the whole family. So planting a sunflower in the ground or container and watching it grow. And I don't know about you, Larry, but I always smile when I see sunflowers.
Oh, absolutely.
And the pollinators love them. And then a container garden with pollinator-friendly plants. And then we'll make a bee house as well. But also talk about things you can do just to keep them safe and invite them to your landscape. The libraries are going to do some of these activities. They're going to have story hours related to pollinators, make and take activities. So check with your local library as well. And all of this information is at atc-growsmart.com/library, atc-growsmart, .com/library. I'm just really excited because I think it's a great way when kids are off in the summer and you're looking for things to do. I sometimes babysit my grandkids, so we're always looking for fun activities and help them understand the importance of pollinators as well.
Yeah, I think it's pretty important for kids to learn that.
Exactly, the good and the bad, sometimes we have that. You know, sometimes the view of insects isn't always positive. And I think gardeners, for the most part, we see the positive, though, when they start eating our plants. Sometimes it's hard to remember. But we want to keep those pollinators safe because that means more fruits and vegetables to eat as well.
Yeah, that's a big benefit of attracting them to your yard.
You bet.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And besides planting plants, some of the things we'll talk about is creating a damp puddle. So just filling a bucket or a shallow container with sand and keeping it damp and sprinkling sea salt or wood ash. And then watch the butterflies and the bees come lap up some mineral-rich water. Plus, it's a great photo op and a place to observe them as well. A flat stone so the butterflies can come to your garden, spread their wings, and warm up. And, of course, providing water is so important. So beyond just the plants, there's all these other things we can do to help support our pollinators.
You are full of good ideas.
Well, you know, it's a lot of fun, and it's a great way. You know, we want to see them as they come visit the garden as well. I have a big planting of Anise hyssop in one of my garden beds, and I was taking some images for a video, and the bees and the swallowtail caterpillars and the silver-spotted skippers were ignoring me as they were nectaring on the flowers, and I was in the midst of all this activity. It was just exciting. And it's one of those feelings that I think I want more and more people to experience that up close to nature experience you could have in your own garden.
And as we, you know, look out the window at the our own landscape and garden, how do we make it more attractive for pollinators?
You know, one of the things is just planting more pollinator-friendly plants. Native plants, of course, are the best because they've evolved with these insects and our songbirds. But when you're selecting plants, native or not, make sure they're suitable to the growing conditions and so that they'll thrive in those conditions. Look for things that have flowers for the spring, summer, and fall, and that way there'll be plenty of nectar for those bees that are visiting early in the season and those that are around all summer and before they head out or hibernate for winter. I find a lot of the cultivated and non-native plants are also helpful. So, you know, if you can't find a native suitable for your design in the space, check out some of the cultivated plants. I like to grow things in containers as well as in my gardens, but I like to bring the pollinators close. So things like cardinal climber, the hummingbirds love it. Ageratums, I'll have hummingbirds and butterflies nectaring on those plants. And I like to keep them right outside my window. Major wheeler, which is a cultivar of our native honeysuckle but resists powdery mildew, I have a vine growing outside my kitchen window next to my hummingbird feeder, and the hummingbirds will nectar on the flowers, and they'll take a sip from the feeder, and then they eat any aphids that appear on my honeysuckle. So they're doing a little insect control for me as well. And then skipping the pesticides, or if you're going to use them, even if they're natural or organic, you want to make sure you're not going to harm the pollinators we're trying to attract. And so we just always want to read and follow label directions. And I find if we tolerate damage, a lot of times nature takes care of those problems. The ladybugs eat the aphids. The parasitic wasps lay their eggs on the hornworms and eat it from the inside out. Talk about fun kid stuff. There's this whole sci-fi thing in the garden. And so there's lots of things we can do just by tolerating some damage, waiting for nature to move in and control those problems. And then if we need to, then we can step in. And then inviting songbirds, because they eat a lot of insects spring and summer. They need them for feeding their young and that source of protein. Plus, they add motion and color to our landscape. So a lot of benefit from working with nature to manage while supporting the pollinators.
The listener wondered if you plant these things in your yard, does it make them more attractive to invasive species for any reason?
Oh, you know, bringing in, if you're doing your native plants, you want to, you know, that's going to help bring the pollinators in. And because they've evolved with our native insects and birds, that's one way to encourage more of the insects we want to come to our yard. Now, if you're fighting Japanese beetles, you know, they're going to eat a wide variety of plants. So hopefully the majority of what you're getting in your garden are the good guys so that you can spend less effort managing the bad guys.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. Melinda Myers, our guest today. Great to have her back for this edition of Garden Talk. If you have a question or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can shoot us an email with a question and even a photo to ideas@WPR.org. Crystal emailed a photo, and I don't know if you've seen it, Melinda.
I have.
A vine with purple flowers that's invading her grass, and she wants to know how to get rid of it.
It looks like, from the picture, corn speedwell, and I feel like I'm invading Doug Sodoth's territory. But a couple things about this plant, as she's probably noticed, it thrives in sun and shade. It usually takes over where the grass is not as dense, so it has a chance to move in and start taking over. Making sure you're fertilizing properly. There's been a lot of research that shows that proper fertilization can do a lot to reduce weed problems. Then make sure that your growing conditions are good for your lawn. If you have compacted soil, you may need to do some aeration or top dress and aerate. Proper watering. I let my lawn go dormant for the summer, but that means weeds have a better shot of moving in. So I have to compromise. This weed is becoming more of an issue in a lot of different lawns. Mm. If you decide to opt for treatment, then, you know, a broadleaf weed killer, read and follow label directions. But I'd start with making sure you're fertilizing correctly. Memorial Day is a great time to do your first application. If it's not on your list of things to do, it might be a good starting point to managing this weed.
That's about the time I will need to be mowing my lawn.
It must be pretty tall.
Oh, my goodness me. I thought I'd just try it because we talk about it so much on the show, and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to try it.
Well, and you know, no mow May, and I appreciate, so Doug, you and Doug had a great interview in talking about lawn enthusiasts and no mow May. And, you know, I tolerate weeds. I live out in the country, so my neighbors don't care. And I think, you know, I see the bumblebees. I was out weeding yesterday, and the bumblebees are nectaring on a lot of the weeds. And it's a great source of nectar. And I think it's the first step in taking care of pollinators. And I think you and Doug made a great point about, okay, if you're not going to do no-mow May because you know you're concerned about the health and vigor of your lawn, then celebrating June is pollinator month and creating pollinator gardens or beefing up your landscape with more native plants is a great way. The next step for those of you, Larry, like you, that let your lawn go for no-mow May, which was excellent, especially as you tell your neighbors what you're doing so they know you haven't left town for a month, and watch the activity because there's a lot of research that shows that they are nectaring. And so this is the next step you can take to support those pollinators.
Chris in somewhere in North America has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi. So good to talk to you. We have just put in a berm. We also have done no-mow May, and our grass is incredible. But I've put in all pollinators, all my plants so far, other than I have some shrubs that are not, some, you know, evergreen shrubs. Mm-hmm. But I need a ground cover for areas that I did not plant and to hold this bank, and I'm wondering, is there anything I can put down that will attract more bees and stuff?
Yeah.
Well, so is this full sun?
Full sun.
So creeping thyme, herbs are great for pollinators. Let them bloom so the bees will come, and it's a nice low growing. It needs well-drained soil and full sunlight. You want to make sure that it is hardy in your area. But that's an excellent one that will creep and really crowd out quite well. Dianthus will also work. The Fire Witch is a cultivar that produces clove-scented flowers. It's a low grower with blue-green leaves. It blooms mostly in late spring, early summer, will repeat. And it's more heat and humidity tolerant than most, so that might be another option. Those are two good full sun sedums are another one. Again, not native, but a great one for low growing. You can select a low growing variety, great for hot, sunny areas. One of the creeping varieties will work quite well for you there. So those might be some things to consider. Some of the sedges and grasses, they're shorter though. So I don't know if they might be too tall for, it sounds like you want something that hugs the ground a little more. There is a cultivar of Aronia, chokeberry, a new one called Ground Hug. They first introduced it as Ground Hog, and I think the marketing people were like, maybe this isn't a good name, right? So it's Ground Hug. And so if you know black chokeberries, flowers in the spring, nice foliage, a great fall color, black fruit that persists until the birds clean it up. Clean them up after they ferment a bit, but great for the pollinators in spring. And this one only grows about 6 inches tall, and it's called Ground Hug Chokeberry.
There you go. Lots of good suggestions there, Chris. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Melinda Myers, our guest today. Jill Nadeau's our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert, our guest today. And we started by talking about creating a home for pollinators in your yard. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe experiences. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Becca emailed from Madison asking about the right time to pull her creeping Charlie. She's let it bloom for the pollinators, and the flowers are starting to fade. Her whole yard and garden are beautifully purple. But she kind of fears for her garden if she lets this go on.
You know, I feel your pain, Becca, because I not only have that, I also have ground henbit, which looks very similar, and it's in full bloom. I would say when the flowers are fading, get it out of there so you don't have a lot of seeds. You will have more coming back next spring because there's probably years of seeds in the soil. And it is one that can be challenging to manage because any piece of the stem that falls back on the ground will start a new plant. So once those flowers have faded and with the recent high temperatures parts of the state have received, I'm finding a lot of those are pretty much done. So pull them out. Make sure if you're composting them, it's in a good hot compost pile, because even though you've pulled them before the seeds have set, many weeds will continue to form the seeds even though the flowers are faded and you pulled them out of the ground. So I would say once the flowers are gone, start pulling, and you'll probably be doing it all season long. But trust me, there'll be plenty of seeds for future.
Yeah. Yes, right. There will. Oh, Mary Lynn in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Mary Lynn.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. So I have overwintered probably about 5 hibiscus plants, and they became infested with what I thought were mites. I treated them throughout the winter with a systemic product, and I have now moved them outdoors, but they still don't look very happy. And so I guess my question is, should I repot them all and then treat them with a topical like soap or insecticide, or should I just treat them with the insecticide, you know, soap?
Yeah, one of the good things, I bring a lot of things in for winter as well and take them out. And one of the things I found is if I can get the plant through the winter, the birds really do a nice job of cleaning up the insects for me, and the plants tend to thrive. We've had such crazy weather. So I'm assuming, Mary Lynn, you've done this before. So you know that you gradually introduced them to the outside, got them used to brighter sunlight, the crazy weather conditions. These hot temperatures for those of us in southern Wisconsin have been hard on plants that I've been trying to harden off too. Sometimes I'm watering twice a day. I would skip the systemic, but you're right. If you don't see an improvement in the next week or two, you might want to go with the soaps. Make sure there's no good guys moving in already. If the plant's been in the same container, you can transplant it. The problem is, the plant's going to put its energy on forming roots to fill that new soil, and it will delay flowering. So hibiscus can usually tolerate being pot-bound. If you haven't fertilized, a flowering plant fertilizer, of course I recommend Moalorganite, will help give it some nutrients, especially if it's pot-bound. And that may be enough to nudge it and improve the growth. And then I'm just worried if you transplant now, you're going to just delay flowering, which is the reason you kept it over winter, right? So you'd
in
have beautiful flowers this summer.
Yeah, absolutely. Mary Lynn, good luck. Thank you. Matt in Superior, your turn. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Do you have any tips for dealing with rabbits eating flowers, and how far back can you cut a large lilac and still have it grow back?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I didn't hear the first part. So pruning lilacs for flowers, was that?
That was one, and the other was, I believe, rabbits.
Oh, rabbits. Okay. So pruning, and boy, the lilacs are in full bloom around my house, and they smell so good. But often what happens with lilacs, right, is the flowers are at the second story, and you can't see them. So I like to do a more of a gradual renewal pruning. So I'll take older stems right back to the ground, a few of them, and then new growth will appear at the base. And then next year I'll do the same thing. And by the third year, you have all new growth coming from ground level You've reduced the height of the plant, less stressful on you, less stressful on the plant. Now, many are tolerant of, if you've got multiple stems, a lot of people will cut the whole thing back just above ground level. Usually the plants can tolerate it, but the problem is I find all that stored energy in the roots, they push up and your stems are just as big, if not bigger, and then you have to do the remove a third to the ground and that type of thing. So that type of pruning will help. Severe pruning done the end of winter, early spring is probably the easiest because you can see the plant. We typically prune our lilacs, forsythia, bridal respirea after they flower for maximum blooming. So you could still do it right after the flowers fade, but you want to do that soon after they fade so you get the flower buds for next year. For rabbits, rabbits eating flowers. Well, fencing is the most effective, but that's usually not what we want to do because we want to look at our flowers. If you do opt for fencing, tight to the ground, at least 4 feet high, or bend it outward so the rabbits can't slink over. And the most important part is keeping the gate secure. I always find when people put up fences and they're not successful that the rabbits have found their way, squeezed through the gate or underneath the gate. I had great success, and I do work with them, so I want to disclose that with plant skid, SKYDD. It's an organic odor-based repellent. And I've had good success keeping the rabbits away from eating my tulips, my Korean spice viburnum, some of my other plants. Also works for deer. But with repellents, any brand you pick, you want to make sure you apply, preferably before they start feeding. You'll have good success. Follow the label directions. Plant skid is rain resistant, so you don't need to apply it after every rain or snowfall. That's one of the reasons I like it, low maintenance person here. But repellents, scare tactics, depending on your area, urban wildlife especially, they're used to us, right? The smell, the sounds. You know, I think you can talk to gardeners who've yelled out the window at the squirrels and the bird feeder. They don't leave. I don't have bear like you might have in Superior, so I wouldn't be yelling at them. But, you know, some of those scare tactics I found didn't work well because they were so used to us. So you might want to try fencing. You might want to try repellents. And that's kind of the best advice I can give.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate the call. Ed in Northern Illinois, we're on to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is a turf question. So I've been letting the clover and violets grow in the backyard. It's a large area.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is there such thing as too much of a good thing? Because some of those patches of clover are getting really big. And I'm wondering, should I, you know, is too much, like I said, too much of a good thing? And if so, how would you kind of control that to take it back a little bit?
You know, that's a great question, and it's only too much of a good thing if you can't stand it, right? Clover was mixed into our lawn seed mixes years ago as a nurse crop because it fixes nitrogen and adds it to the soil with its relationship with the soil bacteria. So a lot of clover was used to help get lawn started, and then we decided it was a weed. So you're great. That's great because the bees love it, and I have a friend that is a hosta enthusiast and leaves the clover in their yard so that the rabbits eat the clover instead of their hostas. Violets, as you probably noticed, not only the clump gets bigger, but when the seeds ripen, they shoot the seeds out, so they start new colonies all over. So it's not a problem unless you decide it's a problem, if it's crowding out things that you want to grow instead of those. I like your idea of just having an area set aside that here's where I'm going to allow the clover, which tends to be drought tolerant, and the violets that add beauty in the spring garden, where you can tolerate it and you're not competing. It's not competing with the other plants you want to grow. And then the problem is keeping them out of those gardens you don't want them to be in. So proper fertilization of your lawn will help reduce clover in the lawn. And then for violets, it's really digging them out when they're in your garden. The same with clover if you don't want it. So they can be a little, both of them can be a little assertive. So it's just trying to manage them, either mechanically digging them out Again, if you're leaving them, I'm guessing that you want to attract the pollinators, so you probably don't want to use herbicides. And so digging is and mulching are your best bets.
Good luck, Ed. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Gene in Menominee is up next. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Yes. Neonicotinoids. We need to be careful when we buy our plants to make sure that they have not been treated with neonicotinoids since they hurt our pollinators and also are long-lived so that they'll stay in the soil from year to year. So you got to make sure that when you are looking at with your grower or nursery, that you ask what type of pesticide that they're using, and then check and make sure it's not a neonic and buy from someplace that doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up, Gene. I forgot to mention that some growers are even labeling their plants as bee-friendly. More and more places are providing plants that are organically grown. So, great comment, Gene. Ask the grower, because if they're not labeled, it doesn't mean they were treated with a neonicotinoid, but it could. And so ask your grower. So great tip. Thank you for sharing that. I forgot to mention it. So excellent tip, since, you know, we're all going to be out buying more plants in the next few weeks. Good thing to keep in mind.
It is indeed. Let's go to Adam in Eau Claire next. Hi, Adam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I really enjoy this discussion. I'm an ecosystem restorationist, and so this is great to get this this kind of exposure. And I just wanted to mention revegetation, some techniques for it, if you could talk about some of them. I've covered a lot of turf grass and removed a lot of invasives, and then or chop and drop, where I just, chop it down less than an inch or so and then put cardboard over it and then add a little layer of topsoil, forest soil, stuff like that to get the mycorrhizae, and then plant my seeds directly in that so it overtakes that so that it's not, disturbing the soil and it's not allowing those weed seeds to come back up. And I just wanted to mention that and see if you could expand on that a little bit for the listeners.
All right.
Well, it sounds like you are more of an expert than I am, and I'm writing down this note because I've got a large area that's weeds and grass, and I want to do more of native plantings on a large scale, but weeds are such an issue, and I like that idea of covering it, which I do in vegetable gardens, use, newspaper, cardboard, and throw down some mulch to keep the weeds at bay. But I like this idea of covering that area, covering it with a little soil, and putting your seeds down so you're smothering the weeds. That's such a great idea, and I think it's a realistic option. And you bring up a good – you probably work very well with your clients, too, to talk about the importance of trying to manage the weeds, getting a natural planting or any garden started. If you've got a lot of weeds in the soil, you need to manage those because native plants and cultivated plants can only do so much to fight against them. So I love those comments. And if you're still on the line, if you have any others to add, I'd love to hear about them, too.
I'm still here. I don't really have anything additional at the moment, though. I don't want to eat up too much time. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, it's great idea.
It is a great idea, and I'll have to tell you, Larry. I'm gonna try this strategy, and I'm gonna give some feedback because I'm very excited. That's such a great idea to manage those weeds and get something started.
I love it too. Yeah, thanks, Adam. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Tessa in rural Bayfield emailed. They promised their local rural electric company they'd maintain the areas under the overhead power line coming to their house in exchange for them to not spray herbicide. They've been doing mowing but would love to grow pollinator gardens under these lines. They need guidance. Do they rototill and seed? And they would like to know how to encourage the electric company to adopt planting pollinator corridors.
You know, that's a great question. So American Transmission Company, their job is to transfer energy. So they're the ones with the huge transmission lines. And so they work with a supplier to establish those pollinator-friendly corridors. And they even monitor for monarch caterpillars and butterflies, so they beef up the milkweed concentration in those mixes. So I don't. You may want to start, since you have a relationship, that's great, to see if they can help you with establishing that, if they are part of the ATC or if they're separate, to see if they can help in terms of getting that established. I like Adam's recommendation. You know, managing weeds, prairie nursery, and I know Neil was on not too long ago, but on his website, he's got lots of information on how to manage weeds. So Adam mentioned the cover with cardboard, soil, and seed. You can solarize, and you might want to do small bits at a time, and basically edging that space, cover it with clear plastic, cook that top few inches, and clear plastic will heat the soil and kill a lot of the weeds, and then plant that way, tilling a couple times a month, but that takes 2 years to get the weeds under control, and most of us aren't that patient, right? At least I know I'm not. So you might want to try some of those things. But I would suggest, I don't know how much space you have, but I know one of my problems is I get excited and I create these huge areas and then I have to manage them.
Yeah.
Right? And so maybe you want to gradually take over and do some conversion that way.
And I haven't looked at the American Transmission Company website. There may be. If there was something on their website about the work that they do, even if this person's
right.
company isn't involved with them.
Yeah, and they cover most of Wisconsin. So, yeah, that's a great point. Go to ATC. GrowSmart will get you to the GrowSmart page. There's videos and information, but American Transmission Company, to their website, they have community grants. They do three for trees, where every time the Bucks made a three-pointer, they donate a tree to a school. So they're really trying to, you know, get plants and things that are good for pollinators and the environment back into our landscape. So good point, Larry. Just check their website. There may be a resource there. They do a lot of, there's a lot that can be done. And somebody on their team probably can help give you some guidance if there's any opportunities for some assistance in your area.
Yeah, good points. Matt in Alloway, it's your turn. Hi, Matt.
Hi there. I'm enjoying the program, especially the thing about the native plants restoration. I've got some tips, too. I've been doing it for over 20 years, and one of the things that I found that was a real breakthrough was that if you're trying to transplant native Northwoods plants, it's very, very good to get some wood that's already rotting and put it down on the soil. And I figured this out. You know, they need the mycelium. And so if you transplant some woodland plants, make sure you get a log that's, you know, half rotted and put it on there, and then put the plants on the log and cover it with soil.
Hmm.
Kind of a hugelkultur native wildflower method. That's a very great idea, because there's the mycorrhizae that they depend upon, and they're those regional mycorrhizae. So excellent idea. Thanks for that tip, Matt.
Hugo culture. I was talking with that about a listener not too long ago. She'd like to do a show on that sometime. So
it's really cool. I have a video on my website. We did one for a Melinda's Garden Moment tip, and also a video for Milorganite. And it gives you long-lasting benefits in a great way if you have branches and brush and things. It's the first layer, and it's using what nature does, but creating a garden with it. So, yeah, I think
it's pretty cool.
It is very cool.
I didn't know much about it, and after I talked with her, I went online and took a look, and I thought, man, this is really interesting.
It's been around for a long time, and I haven't heard this application that Matt shared, so thank you, Matt. This is why I love doing your show, Larry. I always walk away with more ideas than I came with.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it. Joe in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Joe.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. my question is to try to determine if there's an environmentally friendly way to remove Creeping Charlie.
Digging is the most effective. I've had some luck using the products that contain Feheda, F-E-H-E-D-T-A. It's a concentrated form of chelated iron. It's not the fertilizer of chelated iron, but it will kill broadleaf weeds. And if it gets on your grass, it turns them deep green. And so I know Doug addresses this in his, yeah. I think it's the environmentally friendly, I forget the name of his publication. I've seen it sold as EcoSense, but if you read the active ingredients, it would have F-E-H-E-D-T-A or HEDA, H-E-D-T-A, as the active ingredient. And I've used it on Creeping Charlie. It's kind of pricey. So, you know, it works great on small lots or, you know, you might decide it's worth the investment. And again, remember that there's a lot of seed in the soil. So even if you kill the existing plants, it's going to take a few years to get that weed under control.
It will indeed. I removed it all 1 year on my lawn, Lake Home lawn, and it was soon back.
Yeah. You know, when my father passed away, one of my cousins said, when I think of Uncle John, I think of his wonderfully fragrant lawn because it was all Creeping Charlie.
There you go.
Exactly.
Oh, boy. Joe, thanks. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Melody in Racine County. On to you now. Hi, Melody.
Hello. I'm announcing our Herb and Artisan Fair tomorrow, Saturday, at Berner Botanical Garden. It will be a wonderful garden event with plants for sale. We'll have artisan vendors, baked goods. We have three wonderful speakers, Jane Hawley Stevens about tea time in the garden, Michael and Kathy Rock with gardening for hummingbirds, Rory Petrie will talk about ferns, the hidden herbs, and just we hope the weather cooperates with us. We're partly indoors, partly outdoors, so rain or shine, we will be at Berner Botanical Gardens from 9 to 3 on Saturday. And I mentioned, because of some of your themes, herbs can also be great pollinator plants.
Exactly, exactly. Melody, thank you. I don't need much more temptation to, one, go to Berner. It's a great place. We have wonderful botanic gardens in Wisconsin, Green Bay Botanic Garden, Olbrich, Allen Centennial, Berner Botanical Garden. So you could not only pick up some plants, some artwork.
Yeah, and just take a visit around the garden. That's a fantastic place.
Yeah, so thank you for that, Melody.
Appreciate that call. Melinda Myers, our guest today, nationally known gardening expert. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in, too, with your own questions, comments, experiences to share. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send us an email and maybe a photo to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Melinda Myers, a nationally known gardening expert, TV radio host, and author of, and has a new version of her Midwest Gardener's Handbook, All You Need to Know to Plant, and Maintain a Midwest Garden. I always want to put the plant first in that, Melinda. But that's a wonderful book. What have you done something, or what have you done? I haven't seen the second edition. I have the first, but I don't have the second.
You need to make sure you get that. So I updated it. There's some plants that we found out are invasive or potentially invasive that we love that I removed. I added some new ones, some pollinator friendly. Of course, it includes a lot of native plants because they do belong in our gardens. Talking about things like jumping worms that weren't a problem or as much of a problem when the first edition came out. And new varieties, so updating some of the varieties that are available, you know, more disease resistant or more productive. And so it's, I always tell people The part I like best about writing a book is when I get to go out and talk to gardeners and then mention the book. So, but I did update it to make it worth the investment. My first edition came out in 2015. So, you know, a few things have changed a little bit, you know, climate and things like that. So addressing those issues as well. And lots of pictures because, you know, we're gardeners, so we're very visual. So lots of pictures as well.
I'm looking forward to getting a copy.
I will make sure you get one, Larry. Thanks.
Gail emailed a photo. I don't know if you've seen it. And
I have.
Yeah, the milkweed. Is this a milkweed and is it safe to grow?
It is milkweed, and you probably recognize Larry. If you have milkweed in your yard, you're seeing a lot of this right now. Common milkweed, obviously the favorite of the monarch caterpillar. It spreads by seed, but it also spreads by underground rhizomes. And the challenge is those rhizomes are like 6 or 8 inches below the soil surface, and they can be the size, like a half an inch in diameter. So I like common milkweed. I have lots of space where I garden now. I'm trying to keep it in certain areas, but it's not cooperating.
Yeah.
So one of the things to keep in mind, and the flowers are fragrant at night. So I always like to warn people before you put common milkweed in your landscape on purpose, be prepared to manage it if you don't want it everywhere. Cut off the pods before the seeds, you know, are released. You may need to do a little digging to kind of keep it in line and start early before those monarch, you know, caterpillars are present. Sullivan's milkweed is a naturally occurring variety, Sullivan's milkweed, that's a little less aggressive, so that might be an option if you're planting milkweed. Butterfly weed is a good choice. It's less aggressive. So if you're buying plants, that might be one. And there's a new variety that Neil DeBull found called, he named it clay, a naturally occurring variety that he discovered in heavy clay soil because butterfly weed likes well-drained to dry soils to thrive. And so this one's more tolerant of clay soil that so many gardeners have. So yes, common milkweed is a plant that's great for monarch caterpillars. Butterflies, including monarchs, hummingbirds, and bees will nectar on the flowers. It is very aggressive. So that's just one thing to keep in mind as you're managing on your property.
Jeff in Hazelhurst, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I have a plant that's been kind of taking over my lawn out of the woods. I believe it's trout lily. It's a green leafy plant with like purple spots and a little yellow flower.
Yeah.
Is there a way of keeping that from overtaking my actual lawn?
Boy, there's probably people out there wishing that they had that problem.
Yeah.
Had your trout lily, not in the lawn, but in their garden beds as well. Boy, you must have some excellent conditions. I would just say, you know, deadheading may not be the option for you, but perhaps, you know, deadheading, at least those near the lawn, might reduce the amount of reseeding and spreading. Digging will be the most friendly option. I don't know how realistic that is. I'm guessing trout lily really prefers shade, so I'm wondering if your lawn may be a little shady. That's a shadier portion, and using more shade-tolerant grass seed in that area to try to outcompete the trout lily might be a couple of options to try.
I would think that if you just mow it regularly, like when you'd mow your lawn, you'd be able to control that. But
that's a good point, Larry. You know, you're going to have some of those broader leaves, but trout lily, I would think too, the woodland wildflowers are a lot more sensitive than lawn grass. So I assumed you'd been doing that, but maybe if you haven't and have been avoiding it, maybe it's the time to run the mower over them and try that way. And then I would also try overseeding with some shade-tolerant grass if that area tends to be shadier so that it can outcompete those trout lilies as well.
Yeah, all good tips. Jeff, thank you. Karen in Waupaca will give you a chance. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Hi. I have a major problem. It's the garlic mustard that's spreading in my yard and burdock.
What a combination.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Garlic mustard, probably the most eco-friendly thing is to pull. And then when I first started doing garlic mustard pulls years ago, you know, we were told, oh, just pull it. We'd pull it when it was starting to bloom, right? So you can get the roots. It won't resprout, and leave it lay. Well, what then we found out, those flowers continued to grow and form seeds even when they were laying on the ground. So when you're pulling garlic mustard, you want to make sure that you get it out of the area, throw it in a clear plastic bag, solarize it. Many municipalities let you throw invasive weeds into the trash. Check with your municipality. The other thing is, I'd always take separate shoes that I'd work on those mustard pulls or in my own garden. I have boots that I try to use for certain areas, so I'm not taking the seeds to other parts of the yard as well. Mowing it down, if you have that option, before it sets flower, just to kind of keep it shorter, will at least reduce, not eliminate all the blooms, because you know they'll just bloom shorter. I'm not a fan. Some people will use total vegetation killer on the plants that rosette, the leaves that form at the end of the season. But there's some concern about what it does to the soil. And so sometimes getting rid of the invasive, we don't want to make a bigger problem for our native plants. So I don't have any other advice than pull. And I know that's very challenging. But the rewards, when I talk to people who have done that, the wildflowers that come back and all the other benefits are great. For burdock, find a forager. I was talking about controlling burdock one time, and somebody wrote me and said, you know, it's a good-eating plant. You shouldn't be recommending killing it. So maybe if you can find a forager that knows what they're doing, they can harvest it out of your yard. Again, if you're going to opt for a total vegetation killer, what I would do is just wipe it on the leaves so it kills the leaves and the roots, and then you're not subjecting nearby plants or the soil to that as well. Digging, I know they're deeply rooted, so if you don't get the whole root, they come back. And persistence and mowing sometimes will help as well. One other thing I want to plug is the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources invasive plants section on their website. It sometimes can be hard to find, so I usually do Wisconsin DNR garlic mustard or Wisconsin DNR crown vetch. And that will take you through, and they've got options that are cultural as well as chemical. And so that's a great resource to use because, like for crown vetch, which I'm struggling with, mowing at certain times will help manage it. So that's always a great resource that I like to check when I'm struggling with controlling a weed and want to do it more eco-friendly.
Yeah. Karen, there you go. Thank you for calling. Deb in Nina, your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hi, thank you so much. I love your show, especially Garden Talk, and listening to Melinda Myers was wonderful. I wanted to let you know that in Nina at the National Wild Center for the Wild Ones organization is going to be a plant sale tomorrow, all native plants.
Oh.
And the address there is 2285 West Butamore Beach Road in Nina. So it's right between Nina and Appleton. And it's going to be a wonderful sale, and hope lots of people will come out and fill their yards with native plants.
And Deb, I want to thank you because if you go online, I need to plug in some natives that didn't make it in my few of my gardens. And it's hard to find native plants, which is great because that means people are buying them. So here's a great opportunity to support a good cause, wild, you know, the wild ones, and to get some native plants for your garden. So thank you, Deb. That's excellent.
Appreciate it very much. Jim in Rockford, Illinois, on to you. Hi.
Good afternoon. I went to the nursery and picked up some plants of flowers, and turns out they have chicks in them. I wondered how I treat the flats not to injure the flowers.
And you have ticks?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. I've had my first tick of the season, so I'm not too happy about that. So I think it's going to be a great tick year. You may want to do something like a horticulture oil, but you have to have contact. But the lightweight horticulture oils like Summit Year-Round Spray Oil will you've got to get contact, so it suffocates the insect by plugging the spiracles where they exchange oxygen. That might be an option. Again, insecticides, but you'll want to be very careful. If you do opt for an insecticide like a permethrin, which is a synthetic version of pyrethrin, it doesn't have the long-lasting effects that the neonicotinoids do. Or you could try the pyrethrin, which are the plant-derived insecticides, but you need to make good contact. Boy, I don't have any other ideas, Larry.
I don't either. That is a first for me. I have not heard of ticks showing up in nursery plants, but they're everywhere.
They are.
Oh, boy. Melinda Myers, our guest today. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, columnist, and her latest, she's got just released the second edition of Midwest Gardener's Handbook, All You Need to Know to Plan, Plant, and Maintain a Midwest Garden. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today with us on the Ideas Net. Melinda Myers, our guest today, nationally known gardening expert, and just released the second edition of her Midwest Gardener's Handbook, All You Need to Know to Plan, Plant, and Maintain a Midwest Garden. Talking about, among other things, creating a pollinator-friendly garden. And, of course, we'd love to have your questions as well, maybe about pollinator plants, maybe about something else. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Prairie in Clyde, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk in about that, the garlic, mustard, and burdock control. A couple of things about mowing is it seems like timing is important to make it more effective. And when I mow garlic, mustard, I try and hit it right after it's done flowering. And if I mow it, it seems like there's not enough energy in the If you have the root with it, it can go to seed. But if it's just the stem and the seed head, seems like that doesn't go to seed. And burdock, the same thing. I try and hit them when I see that they're done flowering, and I'll mow them off with it. Sometimes I'll even use a machete just to hack the stalk off. And if I can't, you know, don't get around to either of those things. If I wait on the burdock until the end of the season and gather all the burrs in a bucket or a paper bag, and I usually just put them in the fire pit. And it's a biennial, so if you do that for a couple of years, you'll really knock down the population. So.
Oh.
And have some great feelings of revenge as you burn all the pods.
Kind of a nice
thank
idea.
You.
Yeah, thanks,
Those are great
Mary.
Suggestions.
Appreciate it very much. Dave in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess. Sorry. I really enjoy your show. I've listened to it my whole life. So just a quick comment, if I could. The no-mow May is a great concept and a great idea, but I mow when my fruit trees bloom, and I get a lot better results with that. Just a brief comment.
So I'm guessing because you've got the, I'm assuming you're doing that because you've got the fruit trees blooming, so there's a source of pollen for the pollinators, so they'll need to rely less on what's blooming in the lawn, I'm guessing.
Exactly.
Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Exactly.
Okay.
And then I've had good results, and I've had people report to me that with pests, especially rabbits, that Milorganite works quite well.
I can't promote it because it hasn't been approved by the EPA, but I hear the same thing.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it very much.
I didn't mean to speak over you, Dave, and Larry. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it very much. So, yeah, I guess we can't recommend it exactly, but...
But kind of a roundabout way, right. There is information on their website to research. I think it was out of Rutgers University. So...
There you go. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Barbara in Milwaukee emailed to ask, what's happening to the evergreen trees in Wisconsin? She says she's seen so many dying this year. Wonders if it was a winter drought or what was going on.
Well, I think there could be a couple things happening. Last year was hot and dry. Plants that are not in landscapes, nobody's watering them. And then you're right, then we didn't have good snow cover. You know, I'm trying to be patient, but I'm finding some fair amount of dieback in my gardens. You know, I'm waiting, hoping they'll emerge later. But that could be part of it, the drought. You're absolutely right. The other thing, there's needle cast, which is taking out a lot of the spruce, and then once our trees are stressed, they're more susceptible to diseases and insect problems. So I think it's a combination of harsh environmental conditions, diseases like needle cast that are moving through a lot of our Colorado blue spruce, or things that aren't well suited for this area, and then insects that move in on the trees when they're stressed. So I think it's a combination of those things.
Yeah, I would agree. Lisa emailed that if you have sandy, disturbed soil and want to restore it, have beautiful flowers and attract pollinators, she says then plant lupin. You can plant one healthy lupin plant and we'll take care of the rest. It is a pretty plant from the leaves to the flowers. She loves it to spread out.
It is beautiful. When I've grown, and our native lupine is native to more central parts, the Sands, where I'm guessing that's what Lisa is recommending. Beautiful blue flowers. It's a nitrogen fixer as well. If you've grown the cultivated ones, they tend to like cool springs in summer. So shifting to the native, especially if you have the right soils, Lisa mentioned, is a good option. So thanks for sharing that.
Tony in Hixton. We'll go to you now. Hi, Tony.
Hello. I've tried to grow ground cherries early so I get a crop before the frost. And I can't ever seem to get seeds to sprout in the house before they're sprouting out of the garden, too.
So one of the things, you know, isn't that amazing? It's like tomato volunteers, ground cherry volunteers, they have no problem taking over the garden, right? But inside when you're trying to force them. One of the things I like to use is a product called floating row covers, and there's lots of different brand names. And it's a great way to jumpstart the season. I have lots of birds on my property, which I'm happy about, but I've also planted peas and beans and other seeds, turned my back, and they're there feeding on them. So a couple things. Using that, prep the soil, plant the ground cherries, cover it with row cover. It warms the soil, protects the seeds from birds and other animals, and even leaving it intact, it lets air, light, and water through. So that can keep the soil warmer, the environment warmer, and then you'll get an earlier harvest. Even when I plant my tomatoes, you know, end of May, early June, when the soil's warm and the air's warm, I'll sometimes leave them covered because we get those 40-degree night temperatures, right? And we've got some in the forecast for parts of the state, and I'm not even going to – the northern gardeners, you guys are struggling always with the cold nights. And that's one way to protect them, and then you'll boost your harvest, but also speed up the time to harvest. So you might want to try that.
Good suggestion. Good luck, Tony. Appreciate it. Frank in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Hello. I have flowering crabs on a berm where the shoots come up from the roots all the time. Will landscape fabric keep that from happening, or...
Oh, man, I have the same thing. It came with my house, and I pruned them all back. So a couple things you can do is you can do some root pruning. So I picked up a saw specifically for that, just a short-bladed saw, so I could cut it off below ground. That's one way to do it, so kind of pull the soil back, cut it off. There's some sprout check, but what I've found and people have shared with me is that when you spray it, it tends to sprout in other places. The weed barrier will probably drive them to form wherever there's an opening, near the trunk or if there ends up being a rip in the weed barrier. I'm not a fan of weed barrier. I'll just say it right out because I want to improve the soil. And so I like to use organic mulches that when they break down and improve the soil, but, you know, they don't create that solid barrier. Sometimes with weed barrier, some of the problems is the organic mulch. If you put organic mulch over top, breaks down, forms compost, then weed seeds blow in, they root through the weed barrier, and then it's a nightmare to get rid of it. So before you put the weed barrier down, kind of check out the other maybe not so positive aspects of using it to decide if that's going to keep them in line. It's definitely going to discourage them where the weed barrier covers the soil, but make sure it's back from the trunk because as your trunk expands, it can girdle that trunk and cause other problems.
Frank, thank you very much for calling. Jan in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have, it looks like snow on the mountain, but the leaves are all green. And it was aggravating to me, very aggravating, when it was taking over one of the garden beds in my front yard. But now a mass of it is taking over part of the backyard, and there are individual plants scattered throughout the front lawn, and I am terrified.
Yeah, this I'm guessing what you're talking about is also known as bishop's weed or gout weed, and I heard it was called bishop's weed because it was so aggressive even a bishop would curse. So and you're probably there. So a couple things, as you've tried, if you've tried any herbicides, you know it's pretty resistant. And it was once sold as a ground cover because it's so aggressive. So what you may want to do is edge the garden beds where it's really taken over. If you decide you want to save any plants, dig those up, but pot them up because just in case you accidentally took any of the roots or rhizomes of the snow on the mountain, the green variety is even more aggressive than the variegated goutweed. You want to make sure you're give it time to grow to make sure you're not planting it back in. And that way, if you edge the bed, cover with clear plastic, that will, you can solarize. Kansas State recommends 6 weeks during the hottest part of the season. University of Minnesota says 2 to 3. I'd kind of go with 6 weeks if I'm going to do this just to make sure. And then before you plant those other plants you took out back in, make sure there's no gout weed going back in. Regular mowing you've probably been doing in the lawn and seeing issues. Organic total vegetation killers only burn off the top, so you could do the same thing by continually cutting it to ground level as soon as the sprouts appear, but you've got to be persistent more so than the weed. And so those are a few options. If you do opt for a total vegetation killer, read and follow label directions. These potentially kill any plant that the product touches, the leaves or the stems. So you want to be careful when using it before you apply it to the garden. But it is a tough one to control.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, sorry. That's probably not what you wanted to hear, Jan, from Larry and I.
Oh, boy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can still join in, by the way, 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jeff emailed, he has an acre of prairie in Baraboo, wonders how he can eliminate the prolific sumac that constantly invades his prairie restoration.
Yeah, burning is probably the reason we burn prairies. Mowing is the second option, is mainly for the control of woody plants. And I know, and I love the fact your garden talks are recorded. So I know Neil addressed this issue a few weeks ago when he was on your show. So timing is critical based on the prairie and the weeds you're controlling. And Prairie Nursery has some good information on their website. Now, burning isn't always an option. Timed mowing is the second best option. So we're trying to cut those woody plants down so they don't have time to keep sprouting. Again, creating a barrier. I have sumac I watch just marching down the hillside between the woods and my, you know, the more manicured, well, it's not manicured, but my plantings. And that stuff's pretty aggressive. So, you know, regularly pruning can help slow it down. Edging, you know, kind of creating a nice barrier, at least to give you a head start before it encroaches the prairie. But burning and mowing are two of the options. And I'm going to send it over to, you know, go to the expert, Neil DeBull. And that show you guys did was excellent on timing.
Yeah, that was a great program. You could, and you could find that show and listen in. And I just go to Prairie Nursery website. It is a great website, for sure.
Yeah, good information on establishment and caring for prairies and other natural plantings.
Judith in Duluth, Minnesota, emailed to ask what flowering plants or foliage should be planted near fabulous, well-established domestic raspberry plants. She said, wild raspberries have been removed from nearby, as she's heard there's cross-pollination that makes the domestic berries smaller. And she wonders if that's true about cross-pollination. And, of course, any suggestions about what she could plant near those raspberry plants?
Well, great question. Raspberries are another very assertive plant in the garden, to say the least. Where we worry about cross-pollination are the seeds that form. I would be amazed if it did cause the fruit to be smaller. But if it was cross-pollinated and those seeds were distributed by birds and you got new raspberries sprouting from those seeds, that would be where you would find it. It's kind of like pumpkins being pollen, right? You end up with weird fruit, but not that year. It's from the seeds. So I don't think you need to worry about that. Diseases are an issue with a lot of the native ones, you know, infecting your planting. For sunny areas, the problem, you know, I've been weeding my asparagus patch for the last week. And raspberries rank right up there. So anything that's very assertive. So you could go, if you wanted to do something like the thyme, you will still have to weed, but it's pretty assertive. It does flower, so you'll bring in the bees, which are great pollinator plants. Mulching is a good option. Might be easier than putting a ground cover. And I'm not sure if you're thinking just next to the raspberries or if you're looking at underneath those raspberries. But I definitely give the raspberry space to grow because they're going to fill in that space and it'll be easier to contain them, you know, than weeding them out of your nearby gardens. Anything that's full sun, well-drained soil tolerant. I'm thinking in my garden, my raspberries have kind of crossed under the fence that I need to control. And I have all kinds of native plants in that garden. And they're all full sun lovers, so you could do native plants, you know, coneflowers, rudbeckia, liatris, those kind of things that like full sun. But I'd give your raspberries space to grow because they will fill in and spread, and it'll be easier to manage them and keep them contained than weeding them out of your nearby plantings.
Edie in Heartland emailed to ask if false bamboo is invasive.
And when you're talking about false bamboo, I don't know if you mean Japanese knotweed, which a lot of people call bamboo, but it's not a true bamboo, and it is very invasive. There's a lot of good information on the DNR website. I'm working with the aquatic invasive species. The problem with this, if it's in your garden, I've seen it take over a small city lot, and it's hard to kill. It spreads by underground rhizome. It can sometimes spread when you buy in topsoil if it was growing in that area where the topsoil was harvested. If it goes along a bank of a river or a waterway, it can crowd out native plants. It can lead to erosion. So I'm guessing, I don't know if that's the plant you're talking about, Edie, but take a look on the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources for Japanese knotweed, and there'll be pictures of it. And when it first started being a problem, I had somebody call me going, there's bamboo growing in my yard and it grows a foot a day. And I'm like, I don't think so. And it was this plant. It has hollow stems, kind of somewhat crooked, white flowers, reseeds readily. So, yeah, if that's the plant And if it isn't, then we know when you check it out whether I'm, you know, there's something else going by that common name.
Lynn emailed to say she wants to plant under a black walnut tree.
Okay. Yeah, I know. So I quit trying to remember because I don't trust my memory. A couple things to do. Morton Arboretum has a really good list. The problem with black walnut is all the lists are based on observation. Okay, we've seen this one growing, not this one growing. And so it's not complete. And so you may want to check Morton Arboretum, I think Rutgers University, The Ohio State University, I think Purdue has a good site as well. So I usually look at all of those sites and then kind of look at what all consistently say are somewhat resistant. You may want to try some things that aren't on the list of being susceptible or tolerant, but I try one plant and see how it does. The concentration, the greatest concentration is within 50 feet of the trunk of the tree, but I have seen roots grow several hundred feet and go through a vegetable garden, and you can just watch where that root went and the wilted tomatoes, right?
Yep.
So, and if you do a raised bed, line it with landscape fabric so that those roots don't go up into that wonderful soil and then cause problems in that bed, and then remove the leaves and any nuts that the squirrels bury in the garden, because all parts contain juglone that's toxic to many different plants.
Jackie emailed. She has a very established honeysuckle plant and wants to know how and when she can prune it, and can she propagate it by cuttings?
So if it's a shrub honeysuckle, make sure it's not one of the invasive ones. I know their flowers are fragrant, and yes, they do support pollinators, but they also become invasive, crowding out native plants, causing more problems for our pollinators and songbirds. If it's the honeysuckle vine, you know, you can prune it. I like to prune it usually at the end of winter. It will bloom for you on new growth throughout the season. I always have the problem that I enjoy the blossoms all summer long, so I hate to prune it, so it's pretty leggy at the base. And it's kind of hard to prune selective shrubs or stems, so you maybe take it down 2 feet, and you'll be amazed how quickly it will sprout up. That might be one option that you can try. And then layering is a great way to propagate vines, and some shrubs will do it naturally. So you take one of the long vines, and even on a shrub, and about 9 inches back from the tip, make a notch. Sprinkle some rooting hormone, and then bury that part either in the surrounding soil or a pot with potting mix, and anchor it so that part stays under the soil. It will eventually root, disconnect it from the parent plant, and you've got a new plant. And it's called layering.
Melinda, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today, and look forward to seeing you in person or your next visit. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Melinda Myers, our guest today. It was great to have her with us, and she will hopefully be back with us again. I'll be out next week. Jill filling in for me. We'll talk about new advances in containing carbon, and then the weather guys will be making a visit to talk about the crazy weather in May. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.